Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict devotes his catechesis to St. Catherine of Siena, Doctor of the Church, at his Wednesday General Audience. Religious freedom denied. We find out more about a new report that says religious persecution worldwide is increasing, with most of the victims being Christians. And God and suffering. Where the hell is God? That's the provocative title of a new book by a Jesuit priest who talks of the mystery of human suffering, a topic prompted by a tragedy in his own family. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of one of the best-known female saints, Catherine of Siena, the 14th century nun and doctor of the Church. Veronica Scarisbrick reports.
On Wednesday, thousands packed the Paul VI Audience Hall in the Vatican to hear Benedict XVI's lesson on one of the Universal Church's best known and loved saints, Catherine of Siena. Describing her as courageous, intense, and sincere, the Pope said this 14th century doctor of the Church was an advisor to princes, popes, and paupers.
Catherine's spiritual teachings are centered on our union with Christ, the bridge between earth and heaven. Her own virginal entrustment to Christ, the bridge bridegroom, was reflected in her celebrated visions. Catherine's life also shows us the importance of the spiritual maternity exercised by so many women in every age.
In comments in Italian, the Holy Father noted that Catherine was born in 1347 in Siena, at a time of great trouble in the Church and in Europe. At the age of 16, driven by a vision of Saint Dominic, she entered the Dominican Third Order. When fame of her holiness spread, she became spiritual advisor for a wide category of people, including Pope Gregory XI, who at that time resided in the French city of Avignon, and whom she urged vigorously and effectively to return to Rome. Catherine, said Benedict XVI, worked for an internal reform of the Church and encouraged peace between states. For this reason, John Paul II declared her patron of Europe so that the old continent would never forget its Christian roots, and so continue to draw from the gospel the core values that ensure justice and harmony.
From this great saint, let us learn to grow in holiness, love for the Lord, and fidelity to his body, the Church.
Concluding, Benedict XVI said, even today, the Church receives great benefit from the exercise of spiritual motherhood of many women who strengthen people's faith and guide them towards ever greater heights. I'm Veronica Scarisbrick.
Religious persecution or oppression is on the increase across the world, and the majority of the victims are Christians. This is one of the main findings of the 2010 report on religious freedom in the world, compiled by the international Catholic charity Aid to the Church in Need. Covering 194 countries across the world, the 2010 report was formally released in Rome on Wednesday. Among those who presented the new report was Peter Sefton Williams, chairman of the UK office of Aid to the Church in Need, who told me more about its findings.
Well, we're often asked, is religious persecution around the world getting better or worse?
Is it?
And I would say that the overall picture indicated in our research, which covers 194 countries around the world, is that the situation has tended to deteriorate since our last report 2 years ago. In addition to the existing forms of persecution, there is a growing intolerance towards Christianity, especially in countries of the developed world, the first world, so that the term Christianophobia is beginning to be relevant even in the developed Western countries.
And in fact, this was one of the themes that was touched upon last week by the cardinals in their day of prayer and reflection just ahead of the consistory. And I remember that Archbishop Donald Wuerl of Washington was talking about this growing intolerance towards Christianity, that people did not want to see it spill over into the culture today. Do you see that in Britain?
Yes, I think there is a militant atheism, which is one is seeing on the rise, and which is making it very much harder for anyone with a Christian or a Catholic belief to work in, for example, the local authorities or where they're involved in adoption, or in hospitals, maybe where this touches on abortion, or indeed people who work in town halls and the processing, for example, of civil partnerships and gay unions.
And there's also the case, as we're coming close to Christmas, the fact that Christmas has been downplayed. You know, people now don't even want to say Merry Christmas, they say season's greetings. Do you see this as all part of that same picture?
Personally, I wonder if that may have reached its peak, especially when people of other religions have said how ridiculous that form of discrimination, if we can call it that, is. However, I think you have to keep this in perspective, and what we face in countries like the UK is absolutely nothing compared to what some people suffer for their faith in various other countries around the world. I wouldn't like to overplay what we in the developed world suffer. It is a tendency that, which I think is getting worse, but by comparison, where people are suffering and dying for their faith around the world, we have life pretty easy in the UK, I would say.
All right, turning to the situation where, as you say, people are suffering and dying for their faith. Pakistan, of course, is a country that's often in the headlines for cases of persecution against Christians. The Pope himself appealed for the life of a Christian woman in Pakistan who was accused under that country's blasphemy laws. Do you see this as a worrying situation? Is it getting worse there?
Whether it's getting worse or not, in Pakistan in particular, I wouldn't really be able to judge. But we are very concerned about the blasphemy laws in Pakistan. And the blasphemy laws are used not only against Christians, but believers in other faiths and people of different forms of Islam who suffer because they are unjustly accused for blasphemy. And this is used very often as a way of settling private scores or just as a means of bigotry, and has been used in a very pointed and hard fashion against some of the Christians and Christian communities in Pakistan. And that is something that we feel very strongly about, and we have asked on behalf of ourselves and also wider believing communities should be lifted.
And how active is the church in Pakistan in engaging in dialogue with Muslims to try to break down perhaps the mistrust that sometimes or maybe often exists between the two communities?
I have met one or two bishops from Pakistan who've been over to the UK, and they talk about a very active and fruitful dialogue. And it's not a case of the communities staying within their bunker. There is dialogue going on, and I think that will probably form the basis of future good cooperation. But as we see at the moment, there are extremists, religious extremists, in places like Pakistan who are intent on making life very difficult for Christians.
Okay, turning to the situation in Iraq, another country which has been in the headlines, of course, because of the attacks, the targeted attacks against Iraq's dwindling Christian community. How do you see the situation there playing out? Because, of course, it just generally seems to be a growing climate of intolerance. Do you see it that way?
Again, I'm not an expert on Iraq, and I don't really feel qualified to talk about that. But what I can say is that of the 194 countries that we've covered in the report, there are around 21 countries which we have identified as where the believers there of various faiths face very severe restrictions in practicing their faith. And one of those countries most certainly is Iraq.
I haven't got the figures, but I know that Christianity seems to be the most persecuted faith. Can you tell us why you think that Christians are more often targeted than people of other faiths when it comes to a case of religious intolerance?
Yes, we're often asked, as a result of looking at all faiths in this report, which religious group suffers most persecution. And without doubt, all the analysis and all the reports on this subject show, including those provided by international organisations and indeed our own report, that Christians are the group most exposed to persecution worldwide. And we have to go on to say we're often asked...
Do we know why?
Well, we haven't attempted to answer that question here, but this is just a factual report to try and say what is happening on the ground. But we're often also asked which religious group is most responsible for persecuting other groups. And the answer to that and the evidence points in particular to so-called, would say, Islamic countries, and as areas where there is persecution of religious minorities. But such persecution, it must be said, is not confined to these countries, and we wouldn't wish to stress that. And also, within these Muslim countries, it's not just Christians who are very often persecuted, but other Muslims who are of a different variety of Islam. So those two points come very strongly through this report.
Now, this report also covers what you describe as situations of religious persecution or intolerance that are little known, that are not making the headlines. Can you give us some examples of where that is happening?
I suppose from a UK perspective, the people talk very much about the position of Christians, for example, in Saudi Arabia, where you're not allowed to have a church or hold any forms of public worship at all. So that's very well known. Perhaps what is of relevance to the UK situation is the situation in India, where there is a form of militant Hinduism which is on the rise, and there have been forced conversions from people who were Hindus, became Christians, and are now being forced to reconvert back to Hinduism against their will. And that's a subject which we at Aid to the Church in Need have been campaigning on and will continue to highlight.
Well, let's look now at some of the good news. Where are some of the countries in the world where there's been a clear improvement in religious freedom over the past 2 years?
Well, as I say, the tendency is really getting worse, not better, and there have not really been many examples, I'm sorry to say, in the report. We have highlighted three in the report. One is Cambodia, another is Nepal, and another is Bhutan. But given the 21 countries where we've highlighted where they have severe restrictions on religion, three where we've noted distinct improvements, doesn't really redress the balance.
No, certainly it's still in balance. But we've talked a lot so far about when Christians have been on the receiving end of persecution. But what about, as you said, your report covers all types of religious freedom, no matter what the faith is. Can you think of some other cases where other religious groups are on the receiving end of persecution? Can you give us some examples?
Yes, I suppose one would look at the Baha'is in Iran. There's quite a sizable number of those, and they suffer from a legal invisibility and are subject to everyday discrimination in that country in the same way that Christians are as well.
What kind of figures, has your report compiled any kind of figures saying how many people actually lost their lives as a result of religious persecution? Do we have any idea at all on an annual basis how many they are?
No, we don't. We haven't got those specific figures. 2 years ago in our report, we did make an estimate that 200 million Christians were persecuted for their faith, and a further 150 million Christians were suffering from some form of religious persecution. We have this time round tried to put numbers to that again. The figures that we're getting were so disparate that we felt, for the sake of absolute truth and objectivity, we're not quoting numbers this time. But we would just point out that according to the Bishops' Conference of the European Community, in their report in 2010, they estimated that at least 75%, of religious persecution around the world is directed at people of various forms of Christian faith. But as I say, the definition of persecutions of discrimination can be very subjective, and so we are reluctant this time to give absolute numbers.
With this report being published, what impact are you hoping it will have? Who is it intended for? Who are you sending it to?
It's a very good question. We believe, as Catholics, that really religious freedom is a fundamental human right, and we hope that by highlighting the plight of these various religious minorities, we hope to bring, I suppose, firstly some comfort and support to those who are oppressed, and by using this report to publicise their plight, to raise awareness of their situation, and thereby we hope to work towards an improvement.
I was speaking to Peter Sefton-Williams, chairman of Aid to the Church in Need in the UK. Where the Hell is God? That's the provocative title of a new book by the Australian Jesuit author Father Richard Lennart, who talks of the mystery of human suffering. The book comes from his struggle to come to terms with the tragedy that befell his own family when his 28-year-old sister was left completely paralysed from the neck down in a car accident. Father Lennart says he wrote the book after becoming convinced that his struggle and reflection in dealing with his own family's suffering following that accident could help other people maintain their faith in God when tragedy strikes their lives. I began by asking him what made him choose the provocative and somewhat shocking title, Where the Hell is God?
The title Where the Hell is God came from the day that my sister had a car accident and was left a quadriplegic as a result of her injuries. And my mother and I, when we got to the hospital and discovered the extent of these injuries and that she was now a 28-year-old woman who couldn't move anything from her neck down, my mother, who's a daily mass-going Catholic, just turned to me with tears in her eyes and said, "Where the hell is God?" And this was a woman who had total and complete faith in God, and at that moment it just expressed such an anguish, such a sense of abandonment. So that's where it came from.
And what did you answer your mother then?
I said to my mother at that moment that I think it was a rhetorical question, of course, but being a classic Jesuit, I had to answer it. So I said to my mother, "I cannot and will not believe in a God who sat in heaven and said, 'I need another quadriplegic, and Tracy, you're going to do, and so let's get a car accident happening. I don't know that God, I can't love that God, and I won't serve that God.'" And my mother said, "Well, where is God then?" And I said, "Well, I think God is as devastated as we are that this accident's happened, and God's holding on to us, weeping with us." My mother didn't say a word, but 1 hour later, I heard her talking to her sister, who's also her best friend, and her sister must have also said, "Where is God in all of this, Joan?" And I heard my mother say, "Well, Mercia, I can only believe that God is as devastated as we are, holding on to us, weeping with us." And so there was something about that line, the response to that question, that resonated very deeply, that within an hour my mother could have made it her own.
Was your own faith severely tested in the wake of this accident? I mean, because people usually ask, why did it happen? Why?
My faith was severely tested by this accident, not so much because of the event, curiously, but in some Catholics' response to the event. I had people who wrote to me and said, "Tracy must have done something terrible to offend God, and God has seen fit to punish her in this life. So she now needs to accept that punishment, and then she might yet merit heaven." Or things on that theme, that God was getting us one way or another. The second group of people wrote and said, "Well, Tracy's suffering is sending up beautiful building blocks to heaven where she'll have a glorious mansion when she dies," which is commonly called pie in the sky when you die theology. The third group of letters, and we got a lot of these, or I did, people wrote and thought it was consoling to tell us how very blessed we were by God, because we were told to remember that God only sends the biggest crosses to those who can bear them. And I just wanted to scream at that. We had many priests and Jesuits, actually, some Jesuits, who wrote and quoted Isaiah 55 by saying, "My ways are not your ways, and my thoughts are not your thoughts." In other words, somehow God's done this to us and we can't see why, and one day we'll find out, one day we'll discover. And I found that untenable. And then many, many people kept saying, "Well, it's all a mystery, and we just don't know, and we'll never know this side of death." And those responses drove me to more desolation and more despair than the actual accident. So yes, it tested my faith enormously, but mainly the traditional platitudes that sometimes we give out in the face of bad news and suffering, that tested my faith much more.
So what, if you could sum it up in a sentence or two, is the message you're trying to get across in this book?
I'm trying to get across that there's a very, very big difference to God inflicting pain, disease, suffering and death, and God permitting it. And I don't know that many Christians at this stage anyway make that distinction. I think I know people who've walked away from faith over really bad things that have happened in their life because they believe God did it to them and they fall out of love with God. The second thing I hope this book is about is it's trying to move away from those platitudes and just try and recover a God who is our friend, who is accompanying us in the richest sense of that word, is in solidarity with us. And thirdly, I hope the book really puts to death, in a sense, some of the nonsense which passes for decent pastoral theology in the wake of pain and suffering, that these things just don't work. And to say them to people only compounds their pain. It doesn't help them.
What you're saying, though, does fly in the face of the traditional God of the Old Testament, the God, the punitive God, the vengeful God. Do you find that some people find that message harder taken than saying that you're going against the Bible?
I'd say two things in the face of that. Firstly, that if other Christians and other Catholics come to different conclusions about this than I do from what I've written, I'm delighted for that. I'm not arrogant enough to think I've solved the problem of evil. If that was the case, this deserves to be a bestseller. So if other people find another solution more helpful, I'm happy for them. And if they want to believe in a vengeful God, that's fine. The problem with the vengeful God is that we believe not in the old covenant, but in the new covenant in Jesus. And in Christ, we can find no vengeance, no destruction, no death dealing, no inflicting of pain, no sending suffering on his enemies, nor on his friends, not directly. Anyway, so the whole idea is when we see Jesus in action, we say that that's God in action. Therefore, that's the God I want to believe in. And that's completely in line with the New Testament. So I'm happy to move away from the Old Testament witness only because I'm a New Testament person, and in Jesus I see the heart of God revealed, the life of God revealed, and the action of God revealed.
You don't find then that some people say, well, what you're portraying in your book makes God seem rather powerless. There's all these bad, evil things going on in the world, this terrible suffering, yet he can't do anything about it except share in your grief.
Yes, there is. I'm open to that charge. And it is true that I do talk about God's power in the book. There's and also God's knowledge. But actually, I think with every single response to evil always comes up about God's power. Because if God's powerful, I jolly would like him to be a lot more powerful than he seems to be right now. Keep intervening. Intervene much more. Don't heal one person. Heal tens and tens of thousands of people. So I look at miracles in the book, and I look at God's power in the book, and I also look at God's knowledge in the book. Because while I will not walk away from God's presence or God's love, God's power or God's knowledge, I think we've got to think those through carefully. We actually do believe in the Christian tradition that God could keep intervening in the world but chooses not to for our sake and for the evolution and the development of the world. Well, I think the same might be true about knowledge. God could know everything but chooses not to. Or alternatively, God can't know the unknowable, that it is by definition unknowable even to God. Now, that's a departure from the Christian tradition, and I readily accept it. But when you start wrestling with these questions, these are the sorts of issues that come up, and running away from them doesn't help. And simply saying, I'm certainly not saying I've found the answer. I simply know that there between God's power and God's knowledge, accompanying with God's presence and God's love and God's unchangeability, are absolutely essential things for Catholics and Christians to think at if they want to have a coherent and intelligent response to evil.
So do you set out in your book some advice to people who might find themselves in the same situation that you found yourself in after the tragedy of your sister's accident?
I don't directly come with advice. Like, I don't say, here's what you should do. But it's a simple book and it's a small book. And I don't directly come with advice. Like, I don't say, here's what you should do. But it's a simple book and it's a small book and it's an accessible book. I wanted to write something which wasn't a heavy and great tome, but was more a pastoral response to a difficult theological situation and a deep human grief. And each of the seven chapters is really trying to say to people, here's a traditional response we've had, here's another way of looking at it. And if the letters and feedback that I've got, at least at this stage, is anything to go by, people have found it deeply consoling and very helpful. Just as one example, at one stage in the book I say, God doesn't need little angels in heaven. We've traditionally said to grieving mothers who are miscarrying babies, well, don't worry, you know, God needed another angel in heaven, so your baby was taken by God to heaven. I got a letter the other day from a woman who had had four miscarriages 60 years ago, and she wrote to me that she's been angry with God for 60 years until she read that chapter, and all of a sudden she didn't have to believe that God took her babies at all, and that God doesn't need any angels in heaven, though we have no question about where her children are. They're certainly enjoying eternal life. But she's carried that for 60 years, and it's such a vivid image that was once said with the best of intentions. But for this woman, it's been a block to her prayer, she told me in the letter, for the last 60 years. So if that's even the only outcome of this book, then I think it was worth writing.
And has your feedback all been positive, or have there been some dissenting voices that say they disagree?
There no doubt will be, and there have been a few. Sometimes, of course, friends and family who read the book at this stage may not be brave enough to tell me they didn't like it, and I guess there'll be other reviewers. That's fine. I'm serious when I say that I'm not pretending that I've got the last word or the only word on the subject. Importantly for me, my mother's response, who gave us the title of the book, my mother's response was one of the more interesting. She said that after she read the book, she didn't know what she believed anymore, because I was challenging some of the very traditional things that she had grown up with and had at some times found comfortable. Though then she told me she read the book again, and indeed she subsequently read it a third time, and she said, actually, now I find it very consoling. And she left me with the nice thought that she said, you should tell everybody to read it more than once.
And your sister's still alive?
My sister's still alive. She's very well. She had no head injuries. So thank God we've always had her in her personality and character. She's a remarkable woman. She's now 50 years of age. She's had 22 years of being washed, fed, turned, toileted and clothed. She had been a nurse with Mother Teresa in Calcutta for 3.5 years. She'd come back to Australia and nursed the Aboriginal people in the remote outback of Australia. So this was an extraordinary woman when the accident happened. So I owe her so much about discovering about faith, about humanity and indeed about myself that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't have been able to walk with her through the valley of tears and the shadow of death.
And she presumably knows about the book?
Yeah, she's read the whole thing, and she likes the book. I'm fairly careful in the book that at the beginning of it I tell her story, but I let her tell her story. She's written her own book, which is also available, called The Full Catastrophe, and it's about her years in Calcutta with Mother Teresa and then back in the Northern Territory. She said she found it a very interesting and informative book, and she also thought that other people would find it a great comfort and a great support. So the two most important people around whom the book hinges, they were very happy with it, which is a great relief and a great joy to me, I have to say.
I was speaking to Father Richard Leonard, Jesuit priest and author. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.